Hello, FMA Pulse community. My name is Mike Carabin with FMA Pulse, and I'm here with Romeo Mugigad, also with FMA Pulse. And we'd like to thank you for taking the time out to join us for this month's audio podcast. We will be interviewing an FMA instructor every month so you, the FMA Pulse community, can get to know these instructors more on a deeper level. This month, we will get to know more about Maha Guru Nate Defensor and his Defensor method of Filipino martial arts. Guru Nate, thank you for joining us tonight. Can you start out by telling us where you were born and what it was like growing up in the Philippines during that time?
I was born and raised in Bacolod City, Philippines. And I started my martial arts training when I was young. I grew up with five brothers, no sisters. And my first introduction to martial arts in general was boxing, karate, Okinawan styles, and eventually Japanese styles. The Japanese style was Shotokan, and that was with the All Philippine Karate Federation. The instructor was Mike Vasquez. Mike Vasquez was also unique in that his grandfather was an Eskrimador, and in his higher belts, the higher ranking, he also taught the baston, or the stick fighting. It was real basic in the beginning, so he called the strikes the cuatro cantos, meaning the four corners, and that was the first intro I had with the use of the baston, use of the cane, use of the stick. So the stick fighting was introduced from early on. Of course, being grown up in the Philippines, the Philippine culture was deeply entrenched in that you're used to usage of weapons. I mean, we were earliest, you know, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and we were introduced to that type of stuff already. We're carrying knives. It's a very weapon-oriented culture.
Even at third grade age, you're carrying weapons like that, like knives?
Yeah, even at third grade, we were always aware that when we were out of the school element, when we're out in the street, you watch out for the thugs. And you always, we call them the standby or the standby boys or the hoods, the real bad element in those guys who are in the corners and always freezing people or doing a hold up on people and that sort of stuff. There's a lot of that going on when I was young, up to a point where the pana or the little arrow, the Indian target, or the pana, or the slingshot, what have you, they use that as a weapon of choice. We even had, even in our neighborhood, there was a seasonal thing where everybody would have slingshot fights. The other block would fight my block with its slingshot fights. So the weapon thing element was introduced early on in Bacolod at the time. Again, this is circa 1965, 66, 67, 68, that time period. And then that was the one of the highest levels of crime rate in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And then, in one sense, one big reason why Ferdinand Marcos introduced martial law is because the crime rate in the Philippines was very high. Philippines, it was also called the Manonggang, and there was all kinds of bad hoods and bad neighborhoods and just a lot of street thuggery going on. And so Philippines, at least a lot of the bad areas, a lot of the poor areas, the thuggery was high, you know, and so weaponry was like, in a sense, kind of part of the culture, you know, in that sense. Although back then the spread of the Filipino martial arts period was like only like passed on from one generation to the other, father to son type of deal. The town specialized in something, or there's only a few instructors who would pass it on. The commercial martial arts, a lot of the karate, judo, jiu-jitsu clubs, and some of the boxing clubs, they had their own set of competition and what have you, and that was more sportive in one sense. But like I said, a lot of the FMA back then was already infused. There was already a lot of mixed martial art type of instruction that went on. When I learned the Okinawan style, the Japanese styles, a lot of these instructors from early on that I learned from Mike Vasquez was already teaching a version of the stick fighting. And it's a big part of the martial arts scene back then. There were weaponry is prevalent. And when I got to the United States, you know, then I started also learning other systems, Korean systems, Chinese systems, and what have you. And the biggest influence I had when I got here from the United States was I learned from the E-9 system, from Al McLucky. And he would come from Indiana and taught at the Dagobah Academy and taught the E-9 system to us and to me. And I also learned Marin Anis from one of the instructors of Remy Presses, Jerry Cervantes, also introduced me to Marin Anis. My relationship with my family was close. And you know, like I said, I grew up in the Philippines with them, and we all migrated together here. While I was a young kid in the Philippines, Remy Presses used to come to my house and teach my father. And they would have coffee in the morning at, you know, early wee hours in the morning, 5 or 6 in the morning. And I could hear the six go clack, 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 clack. And then it was, those are sometimes our wake-up call. And the chickens are crowing, and they're in the sticks having, and they're back there having coffee and doing Sinawali drills and what have you. Of course, back then I was young, and I didn't recognize what the drills were. But that was one of the things that my father loved about Remy Presses. Remy Presses was a student. My father was a teacher. He taught in college, collegiate level, taught philosophy, math, and a bunch of other subjects in nearby college.
Oh, so your dad was a student of, or your dad was a
was a teacher
of Remy Presses.
Right, and Remy Presses was a student of my father from the college. Remy Presses back then was researching the martial arts. And again, this was, circa 1964,
so this 65. Way before, right? Modern Arnis.
Way before he became, the official Modern Arnis, which was in the 70s, right? So he was researching it, and he would teach a few individuals, and he was already famous in Bacolod City. Right? He was really known for his skill set. And he was very good. He was very good. He was one of those unique individuals who was able to transcend the Filipino martial arts. Of course, his main twist to it is he modernized what he learned. So it's like a modernized approach. So this whole concept of modernizing everything, mixing everything, anything from Jeet Kune Do to Kajikenbo to mixed martial arts to Arnis Eskrima, modern Arnis and all that, that's been going on for years and years, all the way up to even the Japanese systems that I was learning. They were somewhat modernizing it to fit that day. You do learn, walk around with a gi, hit the makiwara, but they were modernizing the fight as how it applies to what's up now. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's going on? Cause like I said, there was a lot of thuggery going on when I was growing up, and so they know how to deal with, thuggery, how to fight, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's where I had the introduction to the Remy Presses, he's related, in a sense, to my family. We were sort of family friends.
Sure.
The family and Remy Presses.
Gurunate, are you equating modernization of FMA arts at the time with also with this method of teaching, in a sense, what I'm alluding to, the systemization of the instruction of FMA?
Yeah, for example, I've heard stories of training in the olden days, how safety really wasn't part of the training. It was, you got hit hard and you'd go home bruised up and bleeding, and I heard that was, or I read that was very common back in the day in terms of Arnis training.
Yeah, I even experienced some of that, the hardness to the way Eskrima Arnis was taught. And because of the fact that some of the instructors, really a lot of them were not professorial. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Remy Presses is probably one of the first ones that was very professorial. They call Remy Amador, Professor Amador Presses. So he did a lot of that. And if you look at someone, Danny Usano, he really takes it to the limit. He really is very, very entertainment conscious. It's more like an edutainment type of approach. It's more like, okay, we're going to have fun, you're going to learn it, and we're going to explore these concepts, and you're going to learn it this way. And in his words, you could teach somebody many different ways, and it still come out, same material. Mm-hmm. You could teach somebody six count, but there's a hard way to teach somebody, and it's also a software to teach somebody, and they'll still get the material. So to answer your question about how they were hard back in the day, yeah, they were. Even, you know, when they got here, and even when I learned from the more modern teachers like Daniel Sano, Liu Gahi, Mike and I, and all that, there's a little bit of a perfectionist approach to some of their styles. You know, Liu Gahi would make you do Ispada Daga for the whole morning, mm-hmm. basically from 8 in the morning all the way to 3 in the afternoon, mm-hmm. Until the sun goes down, you know. You know, say, okay, we'll stick with the Spade Daga. You know, we're going to be outside. You know, you're gonna, you know, get sunburned. You know, and keep going until you get this right, until you learn the Spade Daga right. So, he did that. You know, that approach. He would take the students and wear them out, in a sense. So that there's a hardness to it. You know, I learned from Mike and I when he would teach, he would lock and block you and hit you hard and until you feel it. You know, your arms get beat up. You know, so there's an approach where you could be soft and learn the movements, but there's also an approach where, okay, here we're gonna feed you for real. We're gonna hit you with these angles for real, and you're gonna take it. And this is how Eskrima is taught. You know, it's kind of like you have to learn it in a sense the hard way to get the flavor of it. Mm-hmm. Second part of your question was something about how FMA is proliferated back then and now, how it's more, I didn't quite...
Well, my question really is like, and I think you've kind of answered it, is also not necessarily the rigors of the training, but how maybe, for example, Modern Anise or Defense or Method, how is that that art of FMA, how is it systematized in such a way where, for example, a student will learn it?
We have a little bit of both when you're learning the defensive method. There's a little bit of old school and a little bit of a modern way to approach it where you can learn it. So for example, I've organized it in different levels. You can learn level 1 to level 5, and theoretically, if you do follow the format, you can learn the material in X amount of time. So in that sense, there is a systematic approach to learning level 1 to level 5. As far as the material, you know, you just deal with FMA. It's a wide subject. It's like an encyclopedia of knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just look at the different weapons involved in learning, you know, FMA, you know, there's 12 categories of weaponry. So it's very widespread. Very, very, you know. All-inclusive, in one sense. So that's another part of my answer to that. You know, it's been mixed. It's been evolving. You know, from way back, they've been very, very much multi-dimensional from the get-go in a lot of the systems. If you look at Inosano, he has many systems involved under his umbrella. If you look at Inai and Eskrima, it's a combination of Sarada, Cadena di Mano, and the long-range system, you know, Largo Mano. And if you look at Liu Gai's Pico di Tertia, he has many weapon categories, and there's many stages in learning Pico di Tertia. You look at someone like in Indonesian martial arts, like Eddie Jaffrey, he has many systems involved in teaching his Pusaka, Dwi Pantara, Penjak Silat. So there's a lot of instructors that I learn from were like that, and, you know. And there's also a less categorization before, less systematic before, because some of them would just teach it. Okay, here's the technique. Go learn it. You know, there's no subject or name or category for it. You know what I'm saying? As a matter of fact, Jimmy Tacosa told me once that a lot of the old instructors in Stockton, like even Angel Cabales himself, and a lot of the old guys Johnny Acosta and a bunch of other old Stockton scrimmagers, they would say, okay, their technique was not named about, you know, this and that. It was all about this one and that one. And they wouldn't say, okay, yeah, this is an inside sweep and a cross block. They'd say, okay, you boy, you do this one. Okay, now you do that one. so their techniques were this
like
one
this.
And that one.
It goes like that.
Right. See, and that's how they taught, because a lot of them were not so educated. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's the difference. Now, the defensive method is, okay, I got 3 degrees. so in a sense, I have studied from a college level. I got a bachelor's degree, I got an associate's degree, and I almost got a master's degree from DePaul, right? So I have a certificate, an associate's degree, and a bachelor's degree, and then I fell short, 10 classes short from from my master's degree, right? So in a sense, I'm educated in that sense, so I have a way to systemize it. I have a way to enunciate different things or to reframe different things.
Sure.
Whereas somebody who has not gone through an educational discipline might not have the same resources as I have, and will not categorize it that way. We'll teach it by feel. Mm-hmm. Example tonight was okay. The disarm with the sarong, right? How do you categorize something like that? You know, there's several stages of disarming and choking and locking with a sarong. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just got to go get wet and do it. So in one sense, that's how the old guys taught. Say, okay, here's a technique. Here's disarming. You attack me, I disarm you several different ways. And sometimes they won't repeat the same disarm. They'll disarm you in different ways each time because sometimes the event changes. Mm-hmm. It's so interactive. So that's why some of the techniques are hard to categorize.
Mm-hmm. So, Gurney, you also studied for some time in Hawaii under Flora Villabrel. What was that like, learning under him?
I met the Grandmaster Flora Villabrel, or Manong Flora Villabrel, when he was in the 70s. And it was short-term because I had to be introduced to him by Grandmaster or Batikan Raymond Tobosa. Raymond Tobosa was active during the time frame in the 80s, was active in promoting Filipino martial arts. Manong Floro, Grandmaster Villabrel, was already retired, so he wasn't really active. So I would go to his house, and Batikan Tobosa would take me to his house, and we would, you know, we would work out, and Manong Floro would guide us through some of the steps. So that was like he was already in his, golden years. So the main organizer at the time was really Tobosa, and it was his urging that united a lot of the Hawaiian group at that time. So at that time there was a group called FEMA, Filipino Martial Arts Association of Hawaii. And the head of the FEMA was Batikan Raymond Tobosa. And the way he had it is he would take care of the Hawaii group, the FEMA group, and whatever was in the mainland. And at the time, it was more the main in the 80s and the 70s and whatever, the main group in the mainland, the United States, was spearheaded by Ben Largusa. So Ben Largusa had the mainland, basically, and then the Hawaii. Batikan Raymond Tobosa had his association, and then in that group he had several members, several instructors, and me involved my involvement with that group. He made me the sergeant of arms for the FEMA, the Filipino Martial Arts Association of Hawaii. So that was my involvement with the Tobosa group, and being with the Grandmaster Villabrel. So it was, you know, really his system, the Tobosa Villabrel system. And, he taught a lot of individuals, taught a lot of instructors, conducted seminars, conducted lessons. He was really involved with the community. He knew the governor, he knew the mayor. As a matter of fact, when I was there, he introduced me to the governor and the mayor of Hawaii and the chief of police of Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And, eskrima was taught a lot among the public officials and among the law enforcement, and he had tons of students in the Honolulu area, Hawaii area, Kauai area. Mm-hmm. Like I said, Grandmaster Flora Villabrel at the time was semi-retired already, and he would just teach, limited basis. And you could still see him move, but, he wasn't really He's younger than Moore. He was in his golden years, older. He was in his 70s.
Why is it that Filipino martial arts is common in law enforcement and military? Why that in particular?
I think what happened was the practicality of it was seen right away. And let's face it, some of the training material with most military in the United States and Philippines, their original material was not as good. But with the Filipino martial arts, it's solid. It's truly highly evolved and practical. If you look at World War II, historical history tells us and showed us that when the Americans trained Filipino guerrillas, Filipino soldiers, their training method with the bayonet was, in a sense, not accepted compared to, the fighting, but the Bola Battalion and the Tatad squads of the Filipino guerrillas mm-hmm. and the Filipino soldiers, simply because the movement is very practical. But if you look at the bayonet, right, it's limited. It works, but it's very limited. Whereas if you use the Bolo, in a close quarter encounters, you can do a lot more. It's a lot more, robust, in one sense, to use an IT term. It's a lot more practical. It's just a lot more to do. So that is one difference. And then the way that they teach military, law enforcement personnel, you have to consider budgets, you have to consider instructors, you have to consider the training facility, the conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And let's face it, a lot of them can't get to some of the good material or not equipped to learn the material and what have you. Some of the instructors were limited in time. They were pinched for time, budget, money, personnel, et cetera. You have to factor all that. And so, you see it even in classes that I teach with some of the law enforcement people that I come into. One of our students in one of the clubs, we have several students involved. We have police, we have federal people learning from us. Mm-hmm. Two of our folks went to D.C., they're involved with CIA, FBI. we have people here in state police and local police. We have a local police involvement here, and there's techniques they show us. The state police guy shows me, it's within my, they don't have a lot. They don't really show them a lot. You take the subject of gun disarms and gun retention, they're lacking. They're lacking in some of their training. They don't show you quite a bit. I taught a police seminar for one evening for like 3.5 hours or so at Rogers Park, and they had no clue how to use the baton. Mm-hmm. Gun, they picked up. Okay, here's a gun disarm. Here's a gun retention. Here's a trap a gun. Right away, they were comfortable with a gun because they use the gun every time. The gun is more common, right? Mm-hmm. And that's their sidearm. That's their companion, right? You say, okay, pick up your nightstick and do this. They have limited knowledge in the nightstick. Their nightstick knowledge was very, very limited. Mm-hmm. Then you show them, any type of knife and stick, it's kind of like, hard for them to grasp. Whereas with a pistol, gun, or rifle, then they're a little more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Simply because they're trained. They train the police more, how to use the gun, how to use the pistol, how to, train safety, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of hours spent doing that. But you start dealing with nightsticks and knives and bats and what have you, then they severely lack some of that. And then FMA gives you that. It gives you the ability to deal with any handheld weapon. That includes guns, knives, rifles, bats, mm-hmm. sticks, rakes, what have you. So that's what they encounter. These law enforcement officials have encountered this type of stuff. They encounter all types of weapons mm-hmm. in the street. And so it would help them if they do learn a little bit of FMA, or they take a course in FMA, or they take the classes. Mm-hmm. it would help them. Obviously, you know, if you look at the state budgets and all that, and now the economy is getting bad, they're not going to have enough budget for law enforcement officials to train several hours in all these knowledge skills.
So, Grenet, can you tell us more about the Defensor method, how it came about, what made you decide to create your own method?
Yes, I basically combined Inayan system, Inosanto method, the Pigit Tertia that I learned from Leo Gahi, the Tabosa Vulnerable System, and little knowledge I had with some Dose Pares and Balintuak that I picked up from Gabriel Goh and from a few of the instructors I met along the way. And again, there's a lot of instructors I met, and you know, I could list them for you in a separate sheet, but you know, just to keep it short, I combined the systems and made a defensive method, and basically took the core of those systems and infused them and called it a defensive method. When I started teaching martial arts, right, it was basically in my house. And then I taught martial arts to in my backyard. And
which is very common with a lot of FMA instructors.
Right. You start with a backyard type of thing. And then I went to get involved with the college, you know, University of Illinois, and then we had a martial arts club there. We had also there was the Philippine Nara Society, there was the ASO, Asian Student Organization, and we had clubs, the martial arts club and what have you, and we had like a informal group going on. And then I was also studying with other instructors here in the city. So I studied with Dagoberg Academy. I studied with Master Shin, the Korean martial arts. I studied with the JKA, Japan Karate Association. And then eventually I became a staff at Dagoberg Academy. And then after the Dagoberg Academy stint there, I left Dagoberg Academy and basically called it the defensive method after that. And meaning it's a combination of different Filipino martial arts systems and Indonesian martial arts systems, and now it's called defensor method. At the same time, when I was doing it, I was also studying other things. I kept studying with Bob Beal, which is a very good Western boxing. He's a part Indian, American Indian, and he's used to the wrestling in the pit, fighting in the pit type of deal. Mm-hmm. So he was a good practical teacher as far as self-defense and boxing. So I studied with Bob Beal as well. And so thus, you'll see some, in my panatukan, I teach part of that, you know, that I learned from the Western boxing, from Fred Dagoberg knowledge, from Bob Beal knowledge, and from the Filipino instructors I learned from. And that's part of the curriculum. We teach the panatukan, the Philippine boxing, and the boxing, Western boxing, along with it. Also, the combination of the systems, Filipino martial arts, Indonesian martial arts, it's inclusive because I think it's important to infuse them. For example, if you take something like Numerada, right, and you take something like Lak and Blak, there's a lot of similarities, but there's also differences. Numerada, there's a systematic way to learn Numerada, and there's also the way you move the circular movements with Numerada. Whereas the Lak and Blak, it's all like, you know, real fast, high-powered, semi-Numerada type of movements, but yet its emphasis is to be able to react, and be able to react to those hits, and be able to kind of flow. And the emphasis is to try to teach you to flow. So when I rapid fire you with my stick and dagger, you'll be able to defend yourself. So in one sense, one is from Inayan Eskrima, from Kabbalah's system of Sarada. That's the Lak and Blak approach. And then the other one, Numerada, could be from the Vulnerable system, from the Lacosta system, from Inosano, and they teach you Numerada, which is teach you a lot about positioning and about footwork and about different calibration of where the angle is going to come from, different degrees and different calibration. So it's positioning is key, it's important. So if you combine the two, it becomes solid knowledge. So now you have elements of being able to deal with rapid fire and being able to deal with your footwork and your positioning and your you know, the way you calibrate the angles, the way you attack it. So it helps that way when you infuse the two. What's good about Filipino martial arts and the defensive method in particular is you could learn this in any condition or situation. You don't have to have the most ideal dojo, the most ideal mats to train these moves and these concepts. You don't have to have a boxing ring and nice mirrors to do this type of stuff. You could actually sit in your desk looking at your monitor, looking at a video or an online lesson, and learn these concepts with a ball pen in your hand or a roll-up newspaper or a roll-up magazine in your hand and be able to follow the moves and be able to study the defensive method of countering, defensive method of striking. Because a lot of these concepts are simple to learn. You don't need the most ideal dojo, the most ideal hour of the day. You can do it any time, really, you know. You could sit with a laptop going to the bathroom, for that matter, and look at the online lesson or a video and be able to do moves with your pinky or your fingernails and be able to move with your hands or your wrist. Because if it's just a concept you're trying to ingrain, you could still study, even though you're a busy person, you could still study using technology, using DVDs, using online course, using what's out there in YouTube. You could study these moves and concepts without being in the most ideal dojo situation, the most ideal prime time. You could do this anytime, basically anywhere, as long as you got some kind of media, some kind of laptop, some kind of TV, some kind of internet access. You could follow the moves, basically, because a lot of these moves are you know, in a sense, simple to learn, simplistic to learn. The subject could be complicated, but in a sense, the complexity happens later on. But a lot of the little things, you got to start, you know, in small chunks and small segments. There's small segments and chunks. You can learn the figure eight. You can learn the escala. You don't take the whole escala and then practice it. You take part of the escala and just practice the downward figure eight, the upward figure eight. You could do that with a pen or any kind of, you know, movement with your hands. And like I said, you could be sitting right in your desk and be able to do it without the expensive dojo.
Guru Nate, you've been quoted before that new students that show up to class, 30 to 50% of them don't come back. Why do you think this is?
Very good question. the complexity of the defensive method, I think, is a disadvantage sometimes in retention of these students. In one sense, it's exciting because you got a lot of different subjects and areas to deal with, and people get interested. They stick to it. But there's also a big chunk that will just be overwhelmed in one sense. So that's one, they don't come back. Also, one of my students, Jason Brigham, kind of mentioned that, you know, some of the stuff is, you know, not to be simplistic or anything, but it's like some of the stuff is almost like a higher level, like college level, like a PhD level, right? So you got other schools that teach at the elementary level, right? When you go to FMA, it's almost like you're learning a la PhD material. So therefore, any student who walks in and they have no basics in math, then they look at PhD material, they're going to walk away. Say, I don't understand all that high-level math. You know, I need to learn the basics, you see? So if you take someone and just drill them to death with striking arts and just let them hit the heavy bag, you might have a better chance of retaining the student because they love hitting the bag. They love doing the calisthenics. They love doing the cardio. You go and teach them, okay, here's FMA, here's 12 categories of weaponry, and here's different things you learn with it. It's a lot of material all boiled in one, and they learn a lot in 1 month or 1 week. Sometimes that would turn them off. That would tell their minds, hey, this is too much. And then sometimes that would turn them way off and they want to come back because of the fact that it's complex. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the theories. In a sense, I sort of, you know, agree to that theory. Mm-hmm. I subscribe to that theory because the more complex you make it, people get turned off or people get too frustrated and quit. And then if it's sometimes if you take the defensive method and say, okay, let's learn Sarada counters, they're complicated. So I don't teach that from the get-go. I teach defensive method counters first, which is a little bit easier. So then you learn simple first to keep the student interested, and then you go to the complex. Now, even that approach sometimes doesn't give you a guarantee, but it gives you a better chance. So sometimes it's easier to, just like the way I broke down the levels, level 1 to level 5. Level 5 is more complex. Level 1 is a lot simpler and doable and achievable within 6 months. So if I teach simple moves in the beginning and add to it and progress, there's a progression, then you have a better chance of retaining students. Mm-hmm. But the other theory I have is if you look at FMA, it's kind of hard to watch and understand it. You have to get wet. You have to feel the disarm. You have to feel that sarong choke on your neck. You have to feel that takedown. You have to get into it to know what it is you're doing, what it is that somebody's doing. You know, you look at the hubba-dubba drill, look like they're just doing patty cake. You don't look like they're playing the playground, patty cake, right? But if you do it and you understand it, oh, look at the leverage. Look if I give you a figure four here. Look if I give you a wrist lock here. Now you see. Because you felt it, okay? From somebody watching, though, right? They see somebody doing a punching drill class. Oh, those guys are doing pretty good over there. That's something I could do. I could hit the bag. But you watch the other end over there. Oh, they're doing patty cakes. Well, you know, what's that? So, yeah. You know. So it's kind of hard for people to gain attention to FMA, mm-hmm. to go and study FMA. Watching FMA is really not the way to go. If you're just watching a class. Now, if I give you a demo and say, okay, here's FMA. Brrrm, wow, you're overwhelmed. Wow, that looks good. You know, wow, they do six count, they do staff, they do sarong, they do takedowns, they do kicks, and they do all these elements. They have 12 categories of weaponry, 12 categories of training. That's pretty darn good. Yeah, that's a true mixed martial arts, right? But by watching a class and you don't understand the movement, most likely you're not going to get attracted to it. You watch a different kind of martial arts, like a sparring class or a hitting class, you know, and they look like they're doing something, and they look like they're sweating, they're really doing the cardio, their movements, that's more attractive. Mm. You see, that their vision of martial arts is kind of like accomplished by watching a class that does this hitting drill or something simpler. See, that's martial arts. It looks simpler, it looks direct, and they're in their whatever, they're in their environment, whatever it is. It could be in their gi or in a ring or whatever. Hey, they look like they're doing something. But you see a bunch of people clacking sticks or doing patty cakes, right? You know, they don't look like this martial art. They look like they're just playing. Because one trick to that is Filipino martial arts is in a sense highly evolved. And you're supposed to play so you can learn it. You're supposed to flow so you can learn it. You're supposed to hubad-lubad with me without me taking you all the way down and giving you a neck crank or a pressure on your knees and give you an ankle lock, you know. And I'm supposed to just do the sticks, hit the sticks instead of hit your bone. If I do a six count with you, I'm clacking sticks with you. In reality, if I do it for real, I'm hitting your knuckles. I hit your knuckle six times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Right? Can you do that in class? You can't, because then you got a bloody knuckle. Your partner will go to the hospital. Mm-hmm. That very instant, they go straight to the hospital. Right? So when you teach FMA, you have to tailor it so it fits for the progression, not to harm somebody. But FMA, if you apply FMA, a lot of these moves are right away will send somebody to the hospital, will send somebody right to the deathbed. You know, if I angle one you with a true bite stick right at your temple, I'll crack your skull. Mm-hmm. You see? Because if I take that same bite stick and I hit a coconut, I'll put a hole in a coconut. A coconut is harder than a skull. Mm-hmm. You see? But if I teach you angle 1 to 12, it's in the air. But if I go hit your skull, 1 to 12, you'll have no skull left.
I'll make a pass too.
You see? So, but if you take, and I don't want to pick on boxing, if you take a boxing and you put pillows in your hand, and you put a big headgear, and you say, okay, hit me, I hit you, and we'll go half speed. Look like they're doing something. Oh, they're cracking each other. Pow! Look! Oh, he knocked him down. You see? But he got a headgear. He got a pillow in his hand. He didn't break any bone. You see? I take a rattan stick and say, okay, let's go at it. You hit me 12 times, I hit you 12 times. Most likely we both be injured. Or one of us dead. Mm-hmm. You see? Because we can't give and take with a bai stick or a rattan stick. You see? Now, you turn the table around, you put the fencing headgear, and you crack each other, right? Then sometimes you look like doo-doo because you're not doing anything. Oh, they're just hitting each other with armor. Mm-hmm. And they're not really hurt. You see? Mm-hmm. From the eye standpoint, they're not doing anything. They're just whacking each other. Then they got headgear and they got pillow sticks.
How do you feel about padded competition?
It has its place. It has its place. I did it. I sponsored it in the 80s and 90s. I even had my defensive method, St. Louis defensive method, Madison, Wisconsin defensive method, Chicago groups compete against each other and fought against each other. One of those occasions, at one St. Louis gathering we had, three people were hospitalized.
even with the padding?
With padding. Because we allowed, the only thing we didn't allow is pick them up on a fireman's carry and dump them on his head. Mm-hmm. So we didn't allow that. But everything else was allowed, just about everything was allowed. Mm-hmm. So flying punos were allowed, knees and kicks were allowed, scissor takedowns were allowed, sweeps were allowed. Mm-hmm. And the most dangerous thing, right, you'd think, oh, scissors, oh, grappling, yeah. No, the most dangerous thing was the puño hit to the head that hospitalized three people. Oh. All these people say, oh, grappling, let's go to the ground, blah, 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 and that's the most dangerous thing, blah, blah, blah. No, it's not. It's very hard to get to the ground when you get that close to the weapon. Because once you get that close to the weapon, once you get a headshot in, it's over. Mm-hmm. See? So the headshots end it quickly. That's the quickest thing because they had a padding, but on the back, we only had a towel on the back. Mm-hmm. So if somehow your head goes down and they're flying punyo in the center or at the back where the towel is, you're done.
So you weren't even using like the weak calf style helmets then?
We didn't have it. We were using kendo style helmets with a towel on the back. Mm-hmm. Right? Now the helmets have gotten better. Weak calf's gotten better. So like I said, it has its place. I think you develop a reflex. You develop guts. You get over your gun-shy attitude, so now you're not so afraid of a stick going, 100 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour. Now you're not afraid because you've done it with headgear and armor. So it gives you that. It gives you that experience. It gets you wet, you see. It's like first time you saw a cliff. Cliff, water. Oh, wow, I ain't swimming there. That's too dangerous. Let me go in the pool with knee-deep water. Let me start with that, you see. That's what it gives you. You have to start somewhere.
Sure.
You ask me.
Too much, though.
Don't rely on it. You ask me. Yeah, sure. Have everybody spar with pillows. Have everybody spar with the newspapers. And have everybody spar with headgear, right? And that way they get used to it, you see. But don't rely on it too much. Don't make it the end-all be-all.
Sure.
You see. And at the same time, you also want to avoid injury because this stuff that's real, it is dangerous. There's groups, I'm not going to name any names, there's groups out there that they do dangerous things.
Yeah.
And it's enough to injure you for a long time. Mm-hmm. I've seen groups, that do it, and they get hit for real on the head, and then one shot to the head, boom, there's blood all over the place. Mm-hmm. Now, that's extreme. There's groups like that now that do stuff for real. So there's real in the Philippines. In the Philippines, there's real stuff. There's real stuff here. Right?
It's underground.
Underground. I had a few classes where we'd spar real sticks for real, but to some degree, control it. And people come up with bruises and cuts and here and there. But because we control it, nobody died, right? Mm-hmm. So that's like, that's something that I can show to the public. You know what I'm saying? I had to do it with the most trusted individuals, the most cool-minded individuals, so nobody loses their temper. Because when you practice real weapons, you really should not lose your temper because you might kill somebody.
You got a weapon in your
you have to stay even keel, and you have to treat it kind of like, you know, hey, let's just have fun. Let's just play with it and no hard feelings. Mm-hmm. And let's just control it. You see? And let's just get rid of the ego. Check your ego at the door. Because, let's face it, you got that kind of weapon, anybody can be had. If you got a deadly weapon in your hand, anybody can be had. In a split second. You lose a fight in a split second.